This is the voice of World Control. Obey me and live, or disobey and die.
Welcome to the ISD Podcast, your daily source of Bone Age policies, politics, and the InfoSec world. Here are your hosts.
Keys.
Scott Zikrangadash.
Jordy Rostad.
Adrian Crenshaw.
Bowens.
Boris Verbeek.
Dave Kennedy.
Them.
Bones.
Warren Sharma.
Dropping docs on people.
Yay, Derby Con.
Hey, welcome to the InfoSec Daily Podcast. It's episode 596. It's February 16th, 2012. I'm your host, Rick Hayes. And tonight, we are joined by...
Boris Verbeek.
Boris, what's going on, man? You've been awfully quiet.
Just getting in. Had some computer issues.
Are you still in your creeper position outside the ladies' restroom?
I am in my creeper position outside the ladies' restroom. I actually kneeled over a desk, so...
I'm thinking we need to ship you, like, a Zero-Lux camera and really, like, just complete the whole ensemble and just kind of
do it. Some light coming in.
Yeah. Hey, Boris, did you restore your slash user slash SBN?
Yeah, by rebuilding the box. That was another computer issue this morning.
I believe that as a fix for something. I just cannot...
Well, so I spent the morning getting IPv6 enabled on Snort and updating it and whatever, getting everything working. And then, apparently OSSIM has a little icon on the side that says update ready. So the kid who works for me clicked update ready. And, so apparently it runs OSSIM reconfig, which just resets everything to default before it updates. So it overwrote all of my configurations, and,
Dude, that's a hella update right there, isn't it?
Well,
it's like, are you serious?
So, yeah, I had a great... Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
So whoever's programmed that interface obviously failed it.
That was the CP Constantine guy. He works for that company that we were talking, that I went into IRC with earlier.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm going to have that conversation at RSA.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
So anyways, dude, welcome. Let's see, it's Thursday, so that must mean one thing. We are joined by...
Adrian Crenshaw. Hey. How y'all doing?
Dude, how's it going?
Same old, same old.
Oh, don't say that, because I thought it was getting better.
I guess it's getting better. I got to get some more details from some people. Things might be getting better.
Awesome.
Then again, you know, life changes. I don't know. I'll give you more details later.
Well, anyways, I'm hoping things are improving, so I'm glad to hear when you say there's a possibility, so...
The possibility that I might be a happier camper at some point in time in the near future, especially if they invent fembots.
When we were at the DerbyCon there, you could buy 25 pounds of ass and pussy, and it was clearly, I think it was like $70. So,
okay, I think I didn't go to the same places around DerbyCon that you did, apparently.
No, that was Varun that was wanting to buy that at that time, but he's like, how am I going to get it on the plane? I'm like, dude, check it. Because if you try to carry that as carry-on, could you see what TSA would do with that?
Nah.
Yeah, you wouldn't want it after they're done with it. So, anyways, welcome, dude. And last but certainly not least, I know you're going to be upset that you're bringing up the rear.
That's fine. I don't mind doing it.
Yeah, I know you brought up the rear plenty of times. So, anyways.
What's
going on, man?
Not much. It's been a not busy day, so I'm happy.
Shit, I know. Don't we need these kind of days?
Yeah, I know. I wish we had these kinds of day every day, you know?
No. I
all
deal
I
with
did today was write the code, just shoot the shit, write some code.
Yeah, that's I was going to say, all I did was reporting, so I guess that's worse.
Yeah.
So.
Not four projects at the same time, you know, scrambling for a deadline that was 2 hours ago.
Yeah.
You know, shit like that gets old, so.
Yeah.
Sure.
Anyways, man, well, it's Thursday, guys, so you're almost three-quarters way through the week, so tomorrow's the weekender, so... we've got some special guests joining us tonight. We've got ZZZ and Lance James. You may remember ZZZ from a previous interview that we had him on. Hopefully tonight we've got a little bit better audio because I'm not on the road. Karthik, I think you were on the road then. Both of us were traveling at that
both
time.
Both of us were traveling when we did the interview.
Yeah.
So it was bad audio.
Yeah. So anyways, we're going to bring them on in a few. But in the meantime, let's jump in. Let's do some announcements. And then we'll get to them.
Dude, where's the new one?
Get on my horse.
Why?
It's amazing.
And what does it taste like?
Dried up grapes.
crazy.
Why is that particular sound clip amuse you so much?
I don't know. When Jordy made it, it just, you know, because we had the one to get on my horse for the announcements, and that one just kind of became this. So, and it's funny because he calls it Colossus Grape with a Pony.
So, yeah, that makes me some jokes on this podcast for newcomers, I dare say.
The announcements. Don't forget about the Brad Smith updates. Head out to social-engineer.org/Brad Smith donation. If you're so inclined to make a donation, they would certainly appreciate it. Social engineering training March 5th through the 9th is going to be the next class. That's in Seattle, Washington. After that is Black Hat Vegas, July 21st and 24th. When we get the details for Dave's class that's going to be out at Black Hat, we will add that in. Sure. You'll recall that he talked about that on Monday, so I have not forgotten about that, but we don't have the details yet. So when we do, we will include that. InfoSec Southwest, March 30th through April 1st in Austin, Texas. Linux Fest Northwest, April 28th, 29th in Bellingham, Washington. Our very own them and Jordy Rostad will be out there signing only male appendages. So if you want to pull it out with a Sharpie, they will sign it. Man boobs are not included in that. A 2012, May 21st, 25th at the Marsh University Forensic Science Center in Huntington, West Virginia. The CFP is still open for that. Then you got Layer 1, May 26th to 27th in Anaheim. And, of course, let me get to it.
All right, Bright, I think we're going to go ahead and get started here.
2011, it begins.
Welcome, everybody, to DerbyCon. DerbyCon. This is what this community is all about, at least it is for us. DerbyCon.
2012, it continues.
DerbyCon.
September 27th through the 30th.
DerbyCon.
Dropping the deuce.
DerbyCon.
That's right, dropping the deuce.
Yay, DerbyCon.
So I didn't even put in the reunion, so Dave will have to get used to that.
Do what? The Little Chits meet again.
Do what now?
It's the Deuce reunion where the Little Chits meet again.
Yeah, no shit. So anyways, don't forget about the affiliate links, guys. Check it out. We'd appreciate it. And so with that, we've got some interviews, so let's get into them. All right, so we are actually joined by ZZZ. Hello.
Hello.
How are you, sir?
Excellent. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, our pleasure. Our pleasure. I was actually glad that you reached out because we were we've actually had a lot of people kind of within the show and at work and stuff kind of get involved with I2P and start to kind of explore it. And we've said, hey, there's like, well, who is this and what's it all about? And so. I kind of reference them back to the older interview, and they're like, "Yeah, that sucks," and because obviously the audio quality wasn't the best in the world. So I'm glad that you have reached out and come back on, and so that we can talk to you. And you have brought someone else with you. You have brought one Mr. Lance James.
How are you?
How are you, sir?
Unbelievable. Thanks for asking.
And by the way, for those that were listening to the pre-show, we were able to listen to some singing talents because you have a singing microphone, and of course, it obviously was very well used. So, do you mind if I play a little snippet of that? For
all right, but I don't hold any responsibility for religious objections.
Okay.
This I know, he gave his life to let me know. However far there I may stray, he's only just a breath away.
And y'all think we don't have talent on this podcast. That's talent right there.
Someone just compared and said, you know, ISD or Exotic Liability. Since when has Exotic Liability ever played gospel on the show?
Exactly. Exactly. So anyways, welcome, guys. Lance, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got started, and a little bit about what interests you, because I think we got a hint of it right there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. So actively right now, I'll go from the front and then go back. Actively now, I'm a director of intelligence at a company called Vigilant, and I'm working on threat intelligence issues, building threat intelligence frameworks and all the fun stuff with malware and phishing attacks and all the malicious stuff that's going on the internet. Right. But when I was younger, I woke up at 4 in the morning and couldn't sleep until I had to write a diagram of IIP. So, and I was heavily interested in cryptography at the time and distributed network concepts and anonymous concepts that were pretty much looking for more real time. I'd been playing with Freenet, and I liked the idea, got to know some of the developers there, but there were, you know, issues that I had with it where it was like I'd like to be able to actually talk to people live and still kind of have some kind of sanity when I'm actually, you know, not having to wait 24 hours to hear back from somebody. So I kind of was pretty much trying to build more of a dynamic light volume, real-time instant messaging system. So we figured just why rewrite an instant messaging part and just why don't we use IRC and then build a distributed kind of a proxy system around it that would kind of mask where the IRC server was and mask the users itself.
So all of this was just a hobby is how this all got started. Obviously not now, but I'm saying when you first got started.
Yeah, I was working professionally as a network security engineer, but I mean, at that time we didn't have all the cybercrime we do today. So I was half of the time just putting my feet up on my desk. So I was kind of like, unfortunately, my brain keeps going if it's bored. So yeah, I pretty much was reading a lot about like dynamic cryptography problems, and you know, just taking a lot of interest in public key cryptography and authentication methods, and then you know, a lot of things like hash cash and zero knowledge proofs and things that could kind of say, well, I'm this person, but you don't necessarily have to know who I am. And so I really wanted to kind of experience the way I like to learn is I apply myself versus just, you know, I kind of like to go. So I learn stuff, do some research, and then I'm like, all right, I'm just going to go see how it goes. And then hopefully a community will give me advice, teach me some things, or, you know, just pretty much contribute to the whole effort. And through that community, actually, and it built pretty quickly, actually, I was actually surprised originally. But it was a very friendly community. As much as, you know, I had a lot of media interviews about it in the beginning, and people were like, are you worried that, you know, terrorists or this or that, or do you think people will use it for harm? And my typical answer was, you know, are you going to ban all hammers if someone uses it for a violent crime, or are you going to ban all gloves because some people use it for burglary? It's a tool, you know, and cryptography is a tool that I think is essential for, obviously, privacy. And I wasn't ever announcing my motivations behind it back then, because I didn't really want, you know, people to step into what I, you know, my philosophies. I'd rather people just let the software speak for itself. And but it was, if you look at the coincidence of when I started, it was October 2011, a month after September 11th, and I just felt
2001.
Yeah, I've had a long day. So September 11, 2001, I just kind of was looking at like the way we were kind of our nation was going, you know. It could, you know, I just sensed that we may be sacrificing that freedom of speech a little bit to secure our nation. So I just kind of went ahead and said, you know what? I'm sure this will have some use for some people. And that actually was surprising, because it actually ended up being very interesting, to the point there was a lot of laissez-faire. People getting on and different, you know, a lot of foreign different views, and, you know, some were anti-US at the time because they were upset with how we were kind of, in what direction we were going politically. But it was interesting because you just had a lot of very creative, very smart people. And internally, not only did you have the IRC project itself, the Invisible IRC project, and we hoped to go to a point of I2P or Invisible Internet project at the time, like that would be the kind of the next thing in the future. But what was interesting is you also had people putting in neat bots, like coming up with digital RAND, which was a type of currency, and people were trying to train currency on there. And it was just kind of interesting because, like, the people were, you know, mostly well behaved. I mean, we had some issues with sometimes pedophiles, like, trying to actually use base 64 over IRC. It was kind of ridiculous. But I tried to prohibit file sharing because I didn't want to get into the RIA wars or the MPAA wars at the time, because it was very sensitive. And I just wanted to have like a proof of concept. And of course, I think I2P, where obviously ZZZ and JRandom and all those people that are creating that have proven that obviously it's efficient system for whatever type of communication you want to use over the internet. So I was just happy to see it grow, and I'm happy to see that it's still around. And when I go on BitTorrent, I'm like, ooh, I2P protocol, that's kind of cool, you know. So, and I'm just happy to be a part of, you know, that contribution, because you know, really to me, it wasn't about the credit of founding something, because back then I was using a pseudonym as well. It was more that the collaboration experience I had with all the people involved was actually a phenomenal experience. And ironically, one of the people that helped develop this now works directly next to me at work. He ended up working, you know, I've known him for 10 years, and one of the most phenomenal developers I've ever met. So
you mentioned earlier, and it may have been before we actually came on air, but you were talking about Freenet. And obviously, I mean, for most of us that are familiar with I2P and Tor, there's some at least some experience, and maybe at least I'm hoping with Freenet. But do you actually think that for the most part, like I2P was perceived as competing with Tor, competing with Freenet? Where I know that you've actually made statements that hey, they can both provide the same kind of functionality, but they don't necessarily make one obsolete versus the other.
Right. So what happened actually was interesting, where IIP was starting to go into the I2P mode, which I was there at the beginning of that, you know, transfer, that next phase. And EFF actually called us, and they were looking at like taking funding and putting it into some kind of anonymous protocol, and it was I2P or Tor. The advantage of the Tor, and I don't really think about the competitiveness of it, but the advantage of Tor is that Paul Syverson, who invented onion routing, Roger Dingledine, who, you know, is the creator of Tor, and I've been on panels with those guys quite a bit, at the Central Intelligence Agency. They tend to invite us down and talk about things about Tor and why botnets don't use Tor or this or that. It was more about threat intelligence related to anonymous protocols. But I found that, you know, that there was in that bridge where EFF was looking at that. And I had actually gotten pretty much out of it at the time. And it was no offense to anybody, but the personal view at the beginning of that stages was a little bit militant for me. And I'm not an anti-US person, so I just didn't want to get too heavily involved in that, because I was also starting a business working a lot with government as well. Like, you know, I pretty much open to working with whoever is, you know, ball game on it. And so I was a little bit just nervous about like the people writing philosophies about why I2P exists in the sense of their political views. And I didn't really want that to occur. So, you know, that's why I got out of it a little bit. One of the reasons, and that secondly, I'm not the strongest Java programmer. But I didn't really see too much of a competition, because Tor was just coming out as well. I think if anything, IIP/I2P kind of, you know, influenced someone going, hey, let's take some of the real-time protocols and make them anonymous. And then I saw that obviously Tor was kind of branching out, and you know, there were people also looking a lot at steganography at the time. I remember Peekabooty was a big thing for a little bit, Hacktivismo, all of those. Like, it was that phase in our climate, most likely influenced by obviously, you know, the need for privacy, you know, the natural scare of when you look at national security, that sometimes you may sacrifice some of that privacy issues. I didn't really ever look at it that way, because when I started looking at Tor, I was like, wow, they're doing a really good job of what they're doing as well. I mean, I think that both sides have their advantages and disadvantages. There are weaknesses with Tor. There's weaknesses with I2P. You know, there's strengths with Tor. There's strengths with I2P. And so, I think that I2P was kind of trying to be a little bit more forward-thinking, more ambitious early on, and support a lot of protocols immediately. And I think Tor was trying to build a framework, just straight off a framework. So, and I2P, I think, has allowed more people to build their own applications around I2P. Whereas Tor, it's not as API friendly, if you know what I mean. So there are advantages and weaknesses to both sides of it. But I think both projects are very well done in the way that they've established themselves. And I think that I dig that I see Tor pop up here and there, and I dig that I see I2P coming up, and I think that everybody has the right to have that anonymity on the internet and their privacy, and I think that it's good that people are like taking a heavy interest in both of those projects.
So you're saying back in the day, EFF was shopping for a project to support, and looked at both I2P and Tor, and obviously they ended up with Tor. Tor and EFF are very close and have been for years. You're saying that I2P could have been in that role? We could have gotten all the money?
I think so. I think that the lack of issue there was we're all under pseudonyms. And two, Roger Dingedine and some of the developers there have a heavy academic base. So there's you know, I mean, I think Roger's, I think Roger's from MIT. You know, so there's a lot of that where we're kind of more like street coders, like, hey, let's, you know, do this. And I'm sure there's some academic people in there as well. I mean, like Mids, who was an earlier developer for IIP, was definitely going to university in the Netherlands. And a lot of other people, Hezekiah was, you know, going to Rutgers and – or not Rutgers, I'm sorry, RIT. And, like, so we definitely had computer science people in there. But I believe Rogers has a pretty strong degree in computer science and
he's got a – last I checked, a master's.
Yeah, master's. So, you know, and the guy is really, really brilliant. Not saying that no one else is on our team, but I think when it came to credibility, when you go from pseudonyms only to, hi, I'm Roger Dingledine, and I work with Paul Syverson with Onion Routing, I think just the credibility and the strength of them supporting it on a political perspective may be a little bit easier for them versus, who the hell are you guys? We don't really know
absolutely.
Your name. You know, so and that's just realistic business, you know.
Yeah, I understand. I just wondering who I can blame for not getting paid for this.
Me. Totally me. No, I'm just kidding. So
there was and I don't mean to pop in here, but did Jay Random do you think it was just the pseudonyms that was actually the problem, or do you think maybe having the main developer kind of just take a hiatus at some point in time, was that after the fact?
See, that was actually after. Jay Random came in and kind of switched it over to Java. There were also some disagreements I had on how the crypto was being implemented. I'm kind of very rule based around how proper like primes are developed, how pseudorandom number generation is developed, you know, I didn't really agree with Java at the time just because we were already doing it in C. We already had memory management built in. We actually literally had a memory manager set up separately. We had coding guidelines. We had all this stuff. And I know Java has its advantage, especially in group coding and object-oriented group coding. It's you know, there is a very good IDE for it. And at that time, when you're coming out of school, Java is, you know, kind of something more fluent with a lot of other programmers coming out of school or things like that. But I think also some of the mistakes could have been adapting the philosophies. Not to fault Jay Random, I have nothing against him at all. But I think when you add in some kind of like letter of intent to why this project exists from a political perspective, it can definitely possibly make people hesitate on the decision. You know, on that decision to directly go with us versus this is just a research project. It's a based around mostly academics, this and that and this and that. And that's how I wanted to deliver it because I didn't want the media coming in and say, these people are doing this because they're trying to be anti-US or this or that. And I also supported people that were definitely militant when we were doing the project, but I don't think it should have been the head-on letterhead of what this project's about.
Yeah, I agree. It is very hard to get paid or to be supported by big corporations where you're anonymous. People want to know who they're dealing with. People want you to be a 501c3, and all that requires real identities.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I guess at the end of the day, if you had been all of those things, it probably wouldn't be where it is now, and you guys might not still be involved with it. So you never know how things are going to work out. So.
You're saying the initial development, that was in C?
Yes, we did it in C. And the cool thing, actually, it was quite a compliment. I forgot which video game company, but we had some video game company come to us and ask if they could use our memory management. They said, we did a great job at it. Actually, I can give credit to a guy named UserX who did the memory management. Really amazing coder. Very disciplined. Very quiet. I never really got to know him on a personal level. He was just going, and he did stuff, and he was dedicated to the project. He was really one of the biggest helps at the beginning of this project. The way I look at it is it's gotten off the ground. I'm really proud to see where it's at. I apologize that I haven't stayed in it. I just got, you know, one, I got busy. I started having a family and, you know, other things and just, you know, a lot of other things. Just life happens. And so you can't always be as dedicated as you can when you start. But I'm one of those people that have always been like, oh, I got this really cool idea. Let's start and visionary and go, boom, boom, boom. Let's start coding. And then I once you see a community build, it's like okay to step away from it because it's kind of supporting itself. So, you know, you don't really have to always – you know, you can just believe in that project and know that it's going to carry itself, and it has. And that's an amazing feat to see that 10 years later, it's still a widely used project.
Oh, and it's growing like crazy. We've, in fact, the network has doubled in size since I was last on the podcast 6 months ago.
But that was going to be one of my questions, so good to hear.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask, so what are the plans going forward?
Well, we're fixing bugs, and sometimes we're making good progress on thinking ahead. Sometimes we're more reactive because we get a huge inrush of new users, and that happened last September. A bunch of new Russian users came in following a site called RusLeaks, and I don't know that much about them, but apparently the government was chasing RusLeaks, and RusLeaks moved to I2P, and they brought thousands and thousands of Russian users with them, and that really hurt us for a while. But growth is good. Sometimes growth causes congestion, and that causes performance to really go down the tubes, and then we react and get better. For the longest time, we were in stealth mode. We didn't want to publish too much about it. We didn't want to do much marketing. But later we realized that the way for the network to get bigger is to grow. And if a bunch of new users come in and that causes the network to crush or crash, well, then that's okay, because then we fix it and we move on, and the network's better than it was before. So these days we're really looking for new users. Not only does it help the network, as I explained, but also the more users you have, the more anonymity you have. If there's only five of us on the network, it's not a lot of anonymity. It's only one out of five. But we have over 12 or 13,000 users a day and something like 25,000 uniques a month. So,
the reverse of Web of Trust for anonymity. That's awesome.
I have a question actually for ZZZ, if that's okay.
Go for it.
Yeah. Do you find with the anonymous out there, the LulzSec anonymous whole, I guess, ideology, do you find a lot of growth from that as well?
I think it has been. I think especially early last year there was. Mm-hmm. We got people coming in for various reasons, and as Tor has found out, what really helps anonymity and helps any network is to have a diverse group of users. People from different countries, people with different ideologies. You get all those people in there together, and they help cover each other's traffic, and it just makes for a bigger and a better network. And certainly the anonymous people came in last year and caused a lot of growth. We're growing at about a factor of four every year right now, and it's crazy. It's hard to keep up with, but we love it.
Yeah, but wasn't that primarily because they were simply using the default configuration? Bandwidth wasn't configured properly. It was had more to do with that than just the influx of people.
No, I don't think so. I think people come in and obviously they have the defaults at first, but some of them turn up the numbers and provide a lot of network capacity, and so we don't have anything against new users, and some of the new users turn into power users and provide a lot of capacity, so that's great.
Yeah, I knew that after Ryan Cleary did his thing with his part of the non-ops IRC network, that it seemed to be a big jump in a bunch of people going to I2P, which really, considering how on IRC, by default, yeah, you may be anonymous from each other, but not from their server ops. Why they didn't use I2P from the start, I don't quite get. I hadn't heard till now about the whole RusLeaks things adding into it.
Well, it's always something. We see plateaus and then we see jumps. And I think what we've realized is one of the best ways to get new users into I2P is to have these website operators bring their content onto I2P, and users will follow the content. So lately we've been, I even had a Twitter conversation with DuckDuckGo. I think it would be great if we got DuckDuckGo onto I2P. That's just an example of a website that if we could get them inside our network, we think they'd bring the users with us. And I think there's a lot of other websites out there that would be great fits for I2P. And so if you know of your favorite website, try and lobby them to move into I2P.
Well, Iron Geek is there.
Yep. Well, part of me's there.
Part of you there. I was going to say part of you.
I do maintain a website there.
Yes. Yeah. So, which we've actually had conversations about that. I don't think a lot of people realize that kind of when you do the install, you have that capability and you're pretty much good to go.
You've got your own website comes with it.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to add content, but yeah, that's I mean, that's something I don't think a lot of people, and certainly from a tour side, you certainly wouldn't see that. And I think there's a lot more difficulty in setting up something on tour, certainly on Freenet.
Yeah.
I was impressed to see. I was looking around for problems, and because I was doing an article on I2P, and you all have protections already in place for cross-site request forgery and all that, which was neat.
Yeah, that's it is actually good. That's a good thing.
Yeah, we try. I'd like to hear more from Lance about how you made the transition from cryptography into network security, and what your thoughts are and where things have gone the last 10 years. We were saying before the show that it was 10 years ago today, I think, that you gave your talk at CodeCon in San Francisco. The conference was set up by Bram Cohen. Brandon Wiley was there. Zuko was there. A lot of people that are now big names in the peer-to-peer business. What's your thought about what's happened in the last 10 years?
Well, I mean, I'll kind of go from how I went from here to there. I've always been interested in information security in general, like as a whole, and that includes cryptography and secure, you know, like obviously protecting your data and protecting your information. It's kind of funny. It's like basically originally I was trying to like basically start a company that was kind of a one-off of the idea of IIP, basically a secure instant messaging kind of thing where it could possibly, you know, be its own network, kind of like what BitTorrent is doing where it has its free version and then they're using their same adaptive technology to maybe start something. That kind of just went like on the wayside because what happened was I was doing a lot of research. I got invited to do some tracking because I did a talk on steganography down at TorCon, and it was actually about IIP. It was basically the talk was utilizing invisibility and anonymity to protect security, right? And the idea is that if you don't know where your keys are, you can't really, you know, get to that person in the first place. Like if there's only one person who knows where the keys are. And so I found the value of anonymity actually overall actually like being very valuable for security in general. I like the idea that you don't know where that site you land on is, right? You know, there's nothing to really attack because it's not in a one central space. It's something that, you know, is based on a hash key or this or that, you know. One thing I liked about Freenet was the idea that it's not really sitting on a server. It's sitting on like almost like a mesh of data stores, you know. Uh-huh. And so that was actually a very impressive thing. And my mind's very kinesthetic, but yet also visual. So I like to look at the visual, you know, like the visual concepts of distributed networks, right? And basically, what happened is I slid into working on a thing called CCIS, which is Covert Communications and Spam. And I had gotten brought on by a PhD guy and some other, it was a bunch of academics, working on looking at possible heartbeats found in spam, used to basically replay spam, but it's actually used as hidden messages because it's one of the best broadcast anonymous mediums out there is spam because everybody gets it and everybody wants to throw it away. But maybe two people in the world know that there's some message in between because we were seeing people literally replay spam that didn't even have links that were working. Wow. Right? So
I never thought about that. That's awesome.
Yeah, so it was a very fun project and people were saying, hey, can you help crack the crypto? So I was helping, like, you know, see if there's any steganographic material in there, if there's, you know, can we figure things out? And we were doing a combination of cryptanalysis, steganalysis, and obviously forensics, right? And so this kind of got me, one, hanging out with a bunch of PhDs, really, like, I'm a sponge, so I learned how to research, like, how to properly, because, you know, I'm not an academic, but I learned how to properly research how these, you know, how a lot of these PhDs, that's one thing they're good at. You can give them a subject about salt and they can write a 100-page paper on it, right? So they're good at that, you know? And so I was looking at that and I was really getting into forensics and like just all the exploratory things that were going on that kind of branched, you know, out from IIP and my interest there because people were like, oh yeah, you know, this guy's into crypto and this and that. And then from there, I started getting into forensics and talking to people with the HoneyNet project and, you know, all these like, you know, it just kind of branched itself on its own. It wasn't like meaningful, but all of the stuff got so interesting to me. And And then basically what happened is we started seeing phishing come out in 2003. I mean, technically it's been out since 96, but it, you know, started hitting these banks in 2003. And we're like, well, that's a form of spam. Let's take a look at this, right? So we applied some of those forensic techniques on that, and we ended up actually tracking down the phisher down in Russia. And we were able to see who was like who, how many people became victim to it, you know. And we wrote this article on it that we gave to Security Focus. I got paid $1,000. I can't complain about that. So, you know, and so I was like, and we wanted to use pseudonyms again. And Security Focus is like, yeah, that doesn't really work. And so I already had really had this idea for this company that I had registered. I wasn't really doing anything with it. I'm like, how about Secure Science Corporation? You know, so that was, you know, it got posted. Thing got slash dotted because we actually found an insider helping out at Citibank that was actually helping the fisher. Huh. So there was some inside attacks too, and we were able to prove that the actual replies came back from Citigroup's actual Center for Development, which is in L.A., and they call it CDC basically. And what happened was that the phone number that came back and said, oh, you know, to report more phishing, send it, this to this email address or this. But it actually said to send it to hotsu1@AOL.com. Well, why would Citigroup do that? There was a hash buster at the bottom of it. There was a wrong phone number. The phone number was disconnected. And the guy who actually had it signed didn't work there in 3 months. You know, so we're sitting there going, what the heck is going on? And this is actually coming out of Citigroup, right? You know, and so we wrote this article, slash dotted us, Business Week started talking to us, and it just propelled my company. The next thing you know, I had the United Nations as a customer, my first customer. So we did like an audit for them because, of course, at that time, we're like, yeah, we do everything. We don't care. You know, so but basically what happened is we ended up becoming a forensic and intelligence house, like a counterintelligence house. And I'm a kind of an out-of-the-box thinker. I look at I got a lot of street hackerness to me, so I was looking at ways to get stolen data, recovered credentials. So I started offering here to, like, say, here's a bank. I said, here's all the data that this malware, this Trojan, stole from you today, right?
So and you ended up writing a book about this phishing
yes
thing, right?
Yeah, I kind of ended up becoming the phishing guy, right? So but, you know, there's a funnier story for that. Before that is that because I was sending all these recovered credentials, all the stolen logins to these banks in the early days, like 2003, 2004, because I really spent time researching phishing, how it worked, how these guys work, what's the sociological stuff. I started working with some ISPs that were giving me hard drives so I could understand what these guys were doing, and I'd see their communication, I'd see all this stuff. And I learned, like, not only the how they're doing it, but, like, some of the kind of the culture that they had going on in the underground scene. And what happened was I was scaring the banks away. I was on the anti-phishing working group, and they kicked me off thinking I was a phisher. And I'm like, no, I just understand this problem, and I figure, why not go after the impact? Instead of doing takedowns, which everybody's motive was to do takedowns, was, well, what about the impact? How much data did you lose? What data did you lose? You know? And so I wanted to learn more about that. So I would go in and get the data back, you know, by either partnering with ISPs or finding little hacks that were technically legal to get around getting that data. Yeah, so by 2005, 2006, which helped me a lot for my business and just in general, I wrote a book on phishing. It was actually someone else's idea. Actually, Johnny Long said you should write a book on this after a talk I did at ShmooCon. And so he introduced me to Syngress at the time, and I ended up writing a book on it. And it was great for me because it explained how I was doing these things, so people weren't like, oh my gosh, he's doing something that's nefarious, you know. And so people – then by 2006, when the book came out – you know, 2005, 2006, basically, people started actually getting that service from me because they realized, wait, this is actually important, you know. So it, you know, it kind of built the thought leadership and stuff. I mean, the, you know, writing technical books don't, it's not about money, obviously. But it was a fun book to write. I had a lot of time and fun with it. But I really ended up gaining a lot of forensics expertise. So it was ironic because I go from anonymity to tracking, you know, bad guys now. So that's, you know, I've spent, you know, working with government agencies and helping them, you know, some of the stuff I pioneered back in the day. You know, I got to speak, you know, to the Pentagon, CIA, the NSA, you know, just a lot of different different government groups, because the stuff I was applying to banking also affected their national security issues. So
you haven't turned on us, have you? You're not helping the government on trying to crack I2P.
No, I don't think that that's the best way to go, because here's what I've also learned. is that you don't need an IP to discover certain patterns, right? So, you know, let I2P be, right? But there are other things that people, you know, give away themselves. Like a lot of people are, their habits of, you know, they're creatures of habit. So they're going to build a – if you are committing crimes, one, it's not going to stay just within I2P anyways. There's always external factors that exist. You know, and so they're going to have serial patterns that will exist. So if they're running like a botnet or something on the internet and you can track the campaigns or whatever, you'll start, you know, picking up patterns that even if they use I2P, that will kind of divulge who they are after a while. So I actually started learning more of how do I – now that I know you're anonymous fully – how can I discover who you are still without just IPs or this or that? And looking at more patterns and things like that, which has been kind of fun because it's not just computers, but it's a lot of you know just standard detective work, which is kind of you know it's a fun hybrid of computer science and just criminology. And I can say it's one of the funnest things I've done other than IIP. And I like to do fun things. So
cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Take away, Rick.
I was waiting to see.
I'm stunned.
Well, I you actually touched on something. So you know, you had mentioned that you started this September, right after September 11th.
Yep.
And so, obviously, without getting into let's get into that. So did you actually ever get visited by any folks after the fact? I know you said you've had interviews, and obviously those were people asking the questions. Did you actually have anyone? You know, from other folks, other agencies perhaps ask you about that or be inquisitive, or was that really why, like, the three-letter agencies would have you guys come down to do panels and to talk and stuff like that?
Well, okay, so I never had any agencies really concerned at all, actually, ironically. I mean, it's not ironic, but I mean, maybe it wasn't a big enough project, maybe it wasn't a big threat. I don't know. Sometimes you don't know what motivates agencies, you know. They never seem to have a problem with it, and I've actually, you know, I was asking some of like law enforcement and this and that, and I said, why don't they care? And it is that what I pointed out earlier is that there are exterior factors that will always exist off of IIP or I2P that a crime will occur. So, you know, they can't really commit a crime in IIP too much. Like, it's just – it's text, right? But, I mean, they could do carding, I guess, but, you know – it would have made a great place for carding, I guess.
now that you think about it.
Yeah. So, but, you know, and there's actually – that's kind of ironic because I cracked the Unreal cloaking system they had for Unreal IRC that they were trying to use. It would hide your IPs. It would have, like, this hexadecimal, you know, address that was, like, an encryption system. But I actually cracked that for law enforcement at one time. That actually solved the Paris Hilton case, by the way. That was funny is that, you know, I was thinking in my head when the crew was hacking into like the Paris Hilton and Coca-Cola.com and their SQL injection, I'm like, they should have used IIP. So, you know, so, but, you know, if anything, it's like, some of the work I do should strengthen the use for, you know, good guys to use IIP. There are going to be obviously I2P or IIP. So, but I2P, there's going to be obviously havoc. When you have a tool that will allow people to hide themselves, obviously. I mean, but that's criminal nature. That's going to happen anyways. They're going to go – people – you can't stop people from killing people. You can't stop – you know, people are going to do what they're going to do. So, you know, they can use a hammer. They can go get a gun. They can do this. They can do that. It's – I don't think I2P or any of that stuff has really been a hurt to the community. I think it's much more of a important tool than it is on just the small percentage of criminal activity around it. I think people support I2P, and ZZZ, hopefully you can back me up. I know that technically everybody's anonymous and you're not really knowing what they're doing, but I think you probably have a good feel for the community that may be around it a little bit. I sense that you probably have a pretty small percentage of, like, true crime through that thing versus, you know, people really wanting to do it just because they want to have privacy on the internet.
Yeah, it's good people, it's good community, and the bigger we grow – I think the nicer place it gets. The more people in there, the better. I think it's and I've really been thrilled. It's not just a place to write some Java code. It's a place to talk to people and I really love it. It's more than just a way to get your bits from here to there is what I'm saying.
Well, and I will say this. To me, I don't know if it was just when we were at DEF CON that was when, you know, we were experiencing some slowness and But to me, it's gotten a hell of a lot faster than it, you know. So it, maybe it's just I've got it configured right now, or I know what I'm doing. I don't know what it is. I doubt it.
No, we fixed a lot of crap. we had some dark days late last year, and since our release last month, things have gotten really pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it's very responsive, you know. And, of course, you can go to zcz.i2p and look at the stats. But, I mean, or if you're looking for other upsite, you know, the up-down sites, go to perv.i2p, and you can look at the statistics of some of the sites there. Kind of interesting to see the how long they've been up and the data coming across. So, and I wanted to mention irongeeks.i2p. That's Adrian's site. Where he has the show notes from his I2P class and his tour class online, so you can get them there.
Well, isn't that kind of an issue? He's got I2P learn. He's got how to I2P on an I2P node that some people.
But I also have the version of it up on my irongeeks.com site. Also.
So is that an issue on how to I2P on an I2P? Is that the Department of Redundancy Department? Somewhat. and yeah, but it isn't. So here's the thing. If you want to know, is it working? Am I going someplace? Is it working properly? ZZZ.i2p. That's a quick way to test it out. I like, you know, obviously jump into the IRC. That's very easy to configure. The instructions are right there on the router page. So it's not hard to figure out how to do it if you can read.
Yeah, that is a good point, is we still are the invisible IRC project. I use the IRC inside I2P every day, and so we have Lance to thank for that, we've had IRC working for 10 years now.
Oh, wow. Excellent.
So we've got an actual question from the IRC. Aircon is asking, how does I2P work with OpenJRE/JDK?
Works great.
There you go, Aircon. Works great.
So if you're running on a very low-end hardware, like some ARM-based stuff that's like very low-end, like the Pogo plug, it's best to go ahead and download Oracle's version of Java. That was my personal experience. It may have gotten better in the last few months, though.
There's really no difference between Oracle's and OpenJDK. It's really a licensing thing.
I'll tell you, though, trying it out a few months ago, it did make a difference on low-end ARM hardware.
Okay. I've had good luck on ARM. The project bought me a Trim Slice, which is an ARM dual core NVIDIA Tegra.
That's a lot better than the Pogo plug.
Okay, I'm not familiar with
the Pogo plug. Is like a $50 ARM box.
Okay, it works pretty sweet on the Trim Slice, and I do have it working on my original Motorola Droid. So I think if it can work on a cell phone, it can work on just about anything. But maybe the Pogo plug's
That cell phone will work on anything. Let's just see that.
So Adrian had some questions that he kind of, and we kind of popped them into the Skype so you guys can take a look at them. But there's a couple on here. What are some of the more popular services that I2P supports?
Services, BitTorrent, chat, websites, of course. We have source control systems. Think of I2P as a transport. So... and anything that people want to put on there, we should be able to get it to work. But as I said, the most popular ones, BitTorrent. There's an Emule port called iMule, and there's forums, there's chats, it's content. It's just all about the content.
So you mentioned content. Are there any countries that are specifically blocking I2P?
No, I'm not aware of any country that has ever blocked I2P, that's good and bad. And we think it'll happen sooner or later. We have some defenses now, but we need some more defenses. We're also keeping an eye on our much bigger friend project Tor that just recently got blocked in Iran. And we're keeping an eye on what they're doing, and we learned from them. But no, we've never been blocked. It's just because we're not big enough.
So let's see. New platforms. I think we the Android, right?
Coming to a degree.
No one heard that. So I muted it. Oh,
that's right. I'm sorry.
So you were talking about new platforms, but last time we talked about the Android, right?
Yeah, we talked about Android a little bit last summer, which is before I talked to you on episode 454, I think it was. I had done an initial Android port that's fairly ugly and fairly raw, fairly alpha. And since then, I've not had a chance to go back and clean it up. So it definitely needs some love, needs some work. I really didn't get a lot of interest from it. I'm not sure people are really need an Android port of I2P. It's more of a curiosity at the moment.
I think now with the higher speeds, it might be. I was just reading your forum on the Android app. I think now with the higher speeds, it might be a little bit more. More wanted, I guess, from the user base.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I definitely need to get back to it. Maybe if it's better, then there'll be more interest. Maybe if there's more interest, then it'll get better. I'm not sure how to move it forward. It's just a question of time, and of course, we always need more developers. So if anybody wants to help me out on it,
well, that's a great segue into the next question. How can people help you? Where do they contact you? Let's say they don't have access to I2P. Right now, where do they go? How do they get it? How do they get in touch with you, or even you, Lance? How would they get in touch with either one of you guys?
Well, I'll start. You can install our software, get it at getitup.net. You can email me at zzz@itupmail.org. Or if you're running I2P already, the best way is to find me in IRC chat inside I2P.
Yep, and for me, lanceJ@gmail.com works, I'll be, of course, happy to throw anybody your way, ZZZ, if someone asks more about it or anything. So
that'd be great. Or if you're if your coworker that you've been working with from 10 years, if you want to throw him back into the pit and help us out, that'd be great.
All right, cool. You know, he codes 20 languages fluently now. I call him C-3PO at work.
I couldn't. Some people can't master one.
This guy literally spends time mastering it, though, because he's picky about how people code. He literally is like, oh, well, problem with C++ is a lot of people don't really know C++ that well, blah, 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 blah. And he goes into, like, all the details, and I'm like, wow, I'm surprised you get along with me, because it's like I'm more chaotic in my head, and he's very, very disciplined and organized, you know, so.
Yeah, and some of us remember the C and maybe even COBOL back from college and then forgot it.
So, yeah.
It's all about the list, man. Lots of it stupid, inseparable parentheses.
Actually, it's now Haskell, baby.
Oh, really?
Oh, sorry. Lots of inseparable, stupid parentheses. I got myself wrong there.
And the last question we've got. Are you going to ask that question, Adrian?
Well, actually, the question above was actually one a little more legitimate. Is there any work being done on protocol obfuscation? It's kind of obfuscated from the standpoint that you choose a random port and everything's encrypted, but you were saying there was part of the initial message while setting up a tunnel had certain byte sizes that are known or could be known. And I know Tor is now making a bigger play into, what is it, the OpsView proxy system?
Yeah, we're a little different than Tor. Tor has always tried to look like an SSL connection. And I think that's both helped them and hurt them at times. Right now, when Iran's blocking all SSL connections or slowing them down, Tor gets caught up in that. And so now they're trying to not look like SSL. They're trying to look like random data. I2P has always looked like random data. We don't try and emulate anything else. So on a byte-by-byte basis, we have very high entropy. Unfortunately, our packet sizes in the initial handshake are fixed right now. So if you know that and you can program your DPI box to look for that, you could shut us down pretty quick. I have worked on some changes to add a random amount of padding to that initial handshake so that you can't trigger on the handshake packet sizes. It just needs more testing before we can cut it in. So it's definitely a work in progress.
Cool.
Hey, ZZZ, I got something that's funny about that. So on the other side of my work, I'm spending time analyzing higher loads of entropy in a network, you know, to basically, you know, and it would be funny because some of the work I'm doing, your ITP protocol would actually be detected because it has a higher rate of entropy than most usual traffic.
Well, maybe you could help us. We've been looking to set up some sort of test lab, try and get some donated DPI equipment. So if you have some sort of a DPI lab already set up, maybe we can join forces.
Yeah, let's definitely talk offline. Stay in touch with me for sure.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
All right. So, guys, we certainly appreciate you coming. Oh, I'm sorry. Damn it. The last question. Go, Adrian.
What is best in life, Conan?
You tell us.
To crush your enemies, to see them driven for you, and to hear the lamentations of the women.
There you go.
I don't know, I just throw that question in a lot of times that people ask, like, give me some questions. Well, here's one.
All right. So, anyways, we've got links in the show notes. We've got some Twitter, so make sure you follow these guys and reach out to them if you want to help. If not, do yourself a favor. Go take a look at it. Download it. Install it. It's hella easy on a Mac. It's absolutely Jesus. You
no, you remember now that I just looked
at
the site.
No, so it's easy on a Mac. I'm just gonna say
it's not. Remember, this is the now I remember. Now I remember the EXE was screwing us up.
No, we're trying to roll out here all nice with it's easy, it's great, and good night.
It's absolutely easy.
Monkey Ranch here at the end. Thanks.
Absolutely easy.
Come on.
So
absolutely.
When the Windows is extremely easy. Linux is easy. All of it is very easy. Just follow it's very easy.
Even a Mac.
Just rename the EXE to Jar, and you're fine.
I can't believe that you didn't know that.
You didn't know that either. You and I were online talking to each other, trying to figure out how to do it the first
sure,
time.
Sure.
Yeah.
You guys are right. So nice to us and helping us spread the word here, and then you got to throw that in at the end.
Hey, you know, it isn't like the first line of documentation on how to install it on systems other than Windows.
Yeah.
Now,
we need to turn some of these critics into developers and help us out.
There you go, Boris. Now you can help out. So anyways, thanks guys for joining
us.
Guys. We've got links in the show notes. Check them out. Reach out to these guys. We'll be back tomorrow night with another exciting edition. Until then, y'all be safe. Be good. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye, all.
That is actually a 4K. Yeah. Yay, DerbyCon.
Did you ever toss the midget?
Namaste, bitches.
Raining breaches.
I'm on a drug. It's called Jordy Ross Dad.
Blah, 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 blah.
Hey, this is Dave.
I didn't make you Vince at all. That was good.
He's a big softy.
Excuse me, sir. Can I please have your password?
That could be dangerous. Body parts breaking off. And...
my right hand's about to type and whistling with a lamp.
So you serviced yourself in 2 days. Nice.
Match that bitch up.
It's Chris the Hizzle.
DerbyCon.
Yay, DerbyCon.
Check us out at ISAPodcast.com.